two Cleopatras in our royal barge, my sister and I reclined and let our little rowboat drift out onto the lake. Margaret arched her shoulders, flung one arm over the side, and trailed her fingertips in the water. It was one of those actressy gestures she'd copied from the classic black-and-white movies to which she was addicted. She liked me to watch them with her, and we were allowed to stay up, because our mother said we would learn more from Some Like It Hot than from a year of school.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. The idyllic image that begins Francine Prose's new novel is about to become very tragic. That will not surprise fans of Prose, whose novels fearlessly grapple with dark themes, but leave in them with fierce and often funny intellectual brio. Her latest novel, Golden Grove, takes its name from a poem. It's by Gerald Manley Hopkins, and it begins, "Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving?" The poem is about a child's grief over the passing of the seasons and her own first inklings of mortality. Francine Prose is the president of the Penn American Center, which champions writers' freedoms worldwide. Her numerous novels include Blue Angel and Household Saints, but she's also noted for her nonfiction and essays. This reading of Golden Grove was recorded in September 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit and then read for a little bit and then answer questions. I wanted to talk about how the book began, because it began in a very strange way for me. I mean, as soon as you think you know how you write a book, then it turns out you don't know anything about how you yourself even write a book. This was about 2002, I guess. I was in a hotel room, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and I saw, I mean, I actually had, I was awake, but I had a kind of, it was almost like a vision. I had a vision, and I saw a family. I knew it was a mother and a father, two daughters, standing on the edge of a lake, and it never happens, believe me. Sentences started popping in my head. Whole sentences started just popping in my head. So my husband was sleeping, and always the considerate spouse. I went into the bathroom, turned on the light. I had a notebook with me, and I began to write down sentences and phrases and really whole things. You know, this, I can't tell you how this doesn't happen. It happened. And whole phrases came to me. I wrote it down, and I wrote pretty much... I would say about half of what would later be the first chapter. And then I got home and I looked at it and I thought, I don't know what this is. I have no idea what to do with this. I just don't have no idea. So I put it away. What I did know was that one of the daughters drowns. That much I knew. And then in the spring of 2005, my mother died. And I was barely functional. I mean, I was barely, you know, any of you who've experienced that kind of loss, you know, I couldn't, you know, all, I mean, my main memory of that time was sitting and watching like a Lemony Snicket movie with my kids and thinking, this is the best thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, that's how out of it I was. But then I began to think about the story that had popped into my head, and I thought, well, really, the reason that I hadn't been able to write it or I hadn't known what it was about was that it was a story partly about grief, or mainly about grief, about how people deal with grief, about how people of different ages and people in a family deal with it in different ways, and how everyone deals with it in different ways. I also knew that I wanted the story to be narrated by the younger sister, the remaining sister, whose name is Nika, who is 13. And so following my own advice from reading Like a Writer, I thought, well, let me just go see what there is in the literature about 13-year-old girls. You know, what are the novels that have 13-year-old female protagonists? And I went, oh, Lolita. And that wasn't what I had in mind at all. So, and then I was looking, and it occurred to me that the great novels of adolescence, Huckleberry Finn, Catcher in the Rye, are about boys. They're about teenage boys. And not that, you know, I mean, well, you would think there wasn't that much difference, but in fact, that there's never so much difference as there is at that age. And in fact, the thing that helped the most, I have to say, was I reread The Diary of Anne Frank. And that was immensely helpful. So I was trying to write about both these things, to write about grief, which I was experiencing at the moment, and then to try and imagine my way back to what it had been like to be 13, to be a teenager. So both those things were happening. And I also knew that all the things that I had kind of made use of, that had come in handy for me in the past, certain kinds of satire, humor, whatever, they weren't going to be useful for me in this situation. So I was really, I mean, I might as well have been writing my first novel after all this time, because I knew that I wanted the book to be lyrical. I wanted the sentences to be beautiful. I wanted it to be very emotionally powerful because it was so personal and raw. And at the same time, I wanted it to be kind of elegant and polished. And that was a real challenge for me. So, you know, 130 drafts later, I'm not kidding, here's the novel. So I thought I would read you just the very beginning and then just like a page and a half from the very end. It's not exactly a spoiler. I mean, you kind of figure out what's going to happen early on in the novel. This is the beginning. We lived on the shore of Mirror Lake, and for many years our lives were as calm and transparent as its waters. Our old house followed the curve of the bank in segments like a train. Each room and screen porch added on, one by one, decade by decade. When I think of that time, I picture the four of us waiting in the shallows, admiring our reflections in the glassy, motionless lake. Then something, a pebble, a raindrop, breaks the surface and shatters the mirror. A ripple reaches the distant bank. Our years of bad luck begin. That was how Margaret would have thought. My sister was the poet. I was miss one thing after the next, which is how I remember what happened. But that's not how it happened at all. One thing happened, then everything else, like a domino falling and setting off a collapse that snakes out toward the horizon and spills over into the future. If all the clocks and calendars vanished, children would still know when Sunday came. They would still feel that suck of dead air, that hollow vacuum created when time slips behind a curtain, when the minutes quit their orderly tick and ooze away one by one. Colors are muted, a jelly-like haze hovers and blurs the landscape. The phone doesn't ring, and the rest of the world hides and conspires to pretend that everyone's baking cookies or watching the game on TV. Then Monday arrives, and the comforting racket starts up all over again. Even before that Sunday, I was glad to see the day end. It wasn't that I liked school so much, but the weekends lasted forever. The loneliness, the hours to fill with books, homework, computer, watching old films with my sister, if she was in the mood. Silence, then the Sunday sounds of our house by the lake. My mother playing the piano, my dad's prehistoric Selectric. That Sunday, that first Sunday in May, was so warm I couldn't help wondering, was it simply a beautiful day or a symptom of global warming? Even the trees looked uncomfortable, naked and embarrassed, as if they were all simultaneously having that dream in which you look down and realize you've forgotten to put on your clothes. Two Cleopatras in our royal barge, my sister and I reclined and let our little rowboat drift out onto the lake. Margaret arched her shoulders, flung one arm over the side, and trailed her fingertips in the water. It was one of those actressy gestures she'd copied from the classic black-and-white movies to which she was addicted. She liked me to watch them with her, and we were allowed to stay up, because our mother said we would learn more from Some Like It Hot than from a year of school. It was often hard to tell what our mother meant exactly, except that we learned to flutter our lashes and say, "What's a girl to do?" in breathy little girl whispers. One thing Margaret and I had in common was we could do imitations. We knew whole scenes by heart, like the end of Flying Deuces, when Hardy is killed in a plane crash and then reincarnated as a horse with a black mustache and bowler hat. Laurel, so happy to see him, he throws his arms around Ollie, that is, the horse possessed by Ollie's grumpy spirit. Sometimes Margaret would do a gesture or line and ask me what film it was from. Her silvery laughter was my prize for getting it right. The only rowboat scene I knew was the one in which Montgomery Clift pushes Shelley Winters in the water, and I was pretty certain that wasn't what Margaret was doing. Margaret said, "This is heaven." I wished I could have been like her instead of the kind of person who said, "Don't you ever worry about the polar ice caps melting?" "Debbie Downer," said Margaret, "give yourself a break. It's Sunday, Nico. Take a day off." Squinting, she aimed her smoke ring so they encircled the sun like foggy auras. Margaret had promised our parents she wouldn't smoke. Mom's parents and Dad's father had all died young of smoking-related causes. Both of our parents used to smoke. Their friends had started dying. The new weapon in the arsenal of Mom and Dad's war on smoking was some bad news we'd gotten that fall. Margaret had a heart condition, a mild one, but I worried. She'd fainted the first and last time Mom talked us into doing yoga with her. I still have a photo my father took that day on the lawn of the three of us doing downward facing dog or some other mortifying position that our mom had convinced herself was helping her arthritis. Margaret, Mom, and I are bent till our heads nearly touch the ground, like those snakes that Margaret told me bite their tails and roll after the children they swallow whole. Planted apart for balance, our legs take up most of the photo, downward-facing croquet hoops of descending sizes. What the picture doesn't show is that seconds after it was taken, Margaret collapsed in a pile of leaves. At first, we thought she was joking. Our pediatrician, Dr. Viscott, ran some tests and said Margaret should eat well, exercise, don't smoke. That stutter on her heart graph was something they'd keep their eye on. Margaret knew she could smoke around me. Smoking was the least of the things she trusted me to keep secret. From across the lake, we heard our mother practicing the spooky Chopin waltz that always made me think of ballroom dance music for ghosts. She kept making mistakes and starting over again. She'd wanted to be a pianist, she'd gone to music school, but she changed her plans when she met my dad, and they ran off to be hippies. Margaret had found a snapshot of them picking soybeans on a commune in Northern California. Long hair, overalls, bandanas, a Jesus beard on Dad. For years, our mom had had a job writing liner notes for inserts in classical CDs. Now her fingers were sprouting lumps, but still she tried to learn whatever piano piece she was writing about. "You know what's crazy?" I said. "Every time you blow a smoke ring, Mom hits the wrong note. Maybe she does have ESP." "Maybe I do," said Margaret. Our mother often boasted about her mind-reading powers. I think she meant to scare us out of doing anything she'd disapprove of. She liked to say her own ancestors would have burned her at the stake. Both our parents were the rogue, only children of starchy New England families, so naturally they'd fallen extra hard for the whole peace and love agenda, even though by the time they joined, the hippie movement was mostly over. They'd counted on the world becoming one big organic farm, and when that didn't happen, they'd sort of had to scramble. Our house had been Mom's parents' summer place. She'd inherited it when her father died just before Margaret was born. Puritan family portraits decorated the upstairs bathroom. Mom thought it was funny to hang them there, but the glowering dead men and women had delayed my toilet training until Dad figured it out and briefly turned their faces to the wall. "There's a lot Mom doesn't know," Margaret let another smoky ring slip from between her lips. "Okay, who am I, Nico?" "The caterpillar from Alice in Wonderland?" "Beautiful," Margaret said. I braced myself for the crash that came when Mom made so many mistakes she banged her fist on the piano. Then heavy silence weighed on the air, scooping out a depression. I imagined filling with the rattling of Dad's electric typewriter. It was pitiful how the computer age had bypassed our father completely. He couldn't even swipe his card at the supermarket checkout. Margaret and I had to do it for him, while the checkers smiled sweetly and wished we were dead so they could be our handsome father's wife or girlfriend or daughter. Oddly, Dad's backwardness was never counted among the traits that Margaret, the lover of everything old, films, jazz songs, vintage postcards, and clothes, inherited from him. Golden Grove, Dad's bookstore, was on the corner of Main and West Street. His female customers worshipped him. They'd buy anything he suggested. His real ambition was to write. Ever since I could remember, he'd spent evenings and Sundays working on a book about how people in different cultures and eras imagined the end of the world. He said he planned to call it Eschatology for Dummies. Water kissed the side of the boat. "Sing something," I told Margaret. In the fall, she was leaving for Oberlin with a full scholarship in music. "Like what?" she'd asked, as if she didn't know. At the senior show, she'd sung My Funny Valentine. She sung at half speed, smoky low. She'd gotten a standing ovation. Mom was the first one out of her seat and the last to stop applauding, even though she hated the song and had lobbied hard against it. Why that one, Mom had asked Margaret. There are plenty of beautiful standards. Sing Little Girl Blue if you really want to depress the shit out of everyone, honey. But my funny Valentine, some patronizing jerk telling the poor ugly duckling he doesn't care for mouths a little weak, laughable, unphotographable, he's doing her a favor, even though her figure isn't Greek. What does that mean, I'd said. It means she has a body, said Mom, a normal female body. Margaret said, it's a love song, okay? It's not what I think love is, or you, Mom. It's what one person thinks love is all about. One person, said Mom, one guy. Don't kid yourself. I didn't care if Mom liked the song. I'd heard it as a promise. Some boy would come along someday and love me for myself, even if I was unphotographable or a few pounds overweight. Being someone's laughable Valentine was better than being no one's, funny or not. Margaret eased down her bathing suit straps to get a head start on her tan. I was wearing the sort of one-piece suit that magazines called slimming. I yanked the elastic over where my white, dimpled thighs popped out. Am I fat? I asked Margaret. You have to tell me. You're perfect, Nico. I said, you didn't look. I don't have to, she said. I know what you look like. I look like you do when I was your age. So what you're saying, I asked, though I was pretty sure she wasn't, is that in 4 years I'll look like you? Trust me on this, Margaret said, whether you want to or not. People told us we looked alike, but I couldn't see it. Margaret was the beautiful sister, willowy and blonde. The lake breeze carried her perfect smell. She smelled like cookies baking. She claimed it wasn't perfume. It was her essence, I guess. I was the pudgy, awkward sister. I still smelled dusty, like a kid. Our parents had given us the wrong names. Margaret should have been Nico. I should have been anything else. They told us they'd named Margaret after a line in a poem. They claimed they just liked the sound of Nico, but I didn't believe them. Dad still had his record player and his record collection. That was how Margaret discovered the Velvet Underground and Nico with her chalky, disappointed voice. It was strange how she sounded like Margaret, only hollow and checked out, and with a foreign accent that made it seem she was learning the words as she sang them. Margaret had rented on DVD a documentary about Nico, and we'd watched the sad story of the German superstar who flamed out after her 15 minutes of fame. My sister was silent all the way through. I didn't like how she sat jackknife forward, studying, taking lessons. When I'd asked Mom if they'd named me after that Nico, she'd hesitated and then said, do you really think Daddy and I would name our child after some Wagnerian zombie junkie? By the way, that's another hideous song. Don't be anyone's mirror, darling. Okay, that's the beginning. That's how it begins. 3/4 of the way through, I realized that the book was actually going to be written in a kind of retrospect, so which gave me a lot of freedom because I could do things that a 13-year-old couldn't. So in the very last scene, Nico, having survived this terrible loss and this terrible summer, has grown up. I'm happy to say she's okay. She has a family of her own. And it begins, the scene begins, she's in a foreign country with her family, and she's in a museum, in an art museum. A lot of the book actually has to do with art, with painting, and she's in a museum looking at paintings. Oh, she's looking at a painting of a lake. And she walks into a room, and it's one of those rooms in kind of small provincial foreign museums where every painting in the room is of the same subject, so you can't really see, you know, there are like 20 paintings of cows by a lake and so forth. Anyway, it's a painting of a lake. A lake. It could have been any lake. Behind it was a mountain. Bare red rock stubbled with whiskery pines. On the shore of the lake were 4 figures, 4 shadowy brushstroke columns. It wasn't our lake. It was nowhere I'd been. A nameless lake that a nameless artist had painted a century before I was born. Yet something, the image of the lake or the 4 figures beside it, had awoken in me that old longing to be inside the painting. I told myself, children think like that. Adults know you are stuck in your body. Any attempt to leave would mean knocking on a door that opens only once, only one way. Even so, even knowing that, I kept staring at the landscape. It was nowhere I'd lived as a child. It was only a painting. That was what I told myself, and how I let down my reserve, and then how I forgot myself and let the painting take over. How could it have done that, such a modest little landscape? How could it have so overcome me that I was unaware of anything but the painted lake and the 4 figures and the mountains behind them and then my own shockingly grown-up face reflected in the glass? I felt myself slip out of my skin and become that girl watching her sister dive into the water. I lost myself in the time before and in that innocent landscape until the spell was broken by a museum guard shouting. He was speaking a foreign language, but I understood. He was saying I'd gotten too close. I'd let the current pull me. I'd allowed myself to drift into that hushed and watery border zone where we live alongside the dead. I was grateful to him for calling me back and reminding me where I belonged, in the clamorous, radiant, painfully beautiful kingdom of the living. I'll answer questions.
So I really enjoyed your I really enjoyed your first chapter with its heavy feeling of anticipation and what was going to come. But I did notice that in both that and in the last fragment you read, that you're really marginalizing your men, the father with his Selectric typewriter who's off there kind of on another planet, and then at the end this Towson museum guard like the man from Porlock. And I just wondered how you related that to calling the book then Golden Grove, which clearly centers it on the father's bookstore.
I mean, the father is a very appealing character in point of fact, but there's a very important character, which is the boyfriend of the drowned sister. There's a very kind of tangled involvement with the boyfriend, who's an extremely complicated character. The father was easy to make sympathetic, but I knew that the novel wouldn't work unless the boyfriend was also sympathetic. I've lived in a predominantly male household for most of my adult life, so it was kind of easy to write male characters. But so even though I'm writing about myself in a certain way, it was much more challenging. But there are guys in the novel, you know.
I was just wondering if you could explain why you chose to focus on the grief of the sibling, because I lost my brother when I was a teenager, and I think the grief that you have losing a brother or a sister is very different from a son or a daughter or a parent, and it's maybe something that people don't appreciate quite as much all the time. And I was wondering if you could explain why you chose that.
Part of what I was writing about and part of what my characters are going through was the mystery of absence, which is, no matter what the age of the person who's absent is, you know, how is it possible that someone who is there isn't there anymore? It seems impossible. So, and also because of what I know of siblings, I mean, I raised two boys, I have a brother, but I'm close to families in which they're sisters and so forth. So one of the things I knew, for example, was that with sisters, the question of who gets to wear whose clothes is often a big deal. You know, who's borrowing whose clothes. So when one of the sisters is suddenly gone, that becomes a kind of big issue in the thing. But again, it happens. I mean, I remember reading The Year of Magical Thinking when I was writing the book, and Joan Didion was writing about, you know, seeing her husband's shoes and the shock of that. Well, those things, I think, carry over from one thing. You know, it's worse. It's obviously worse. I mean, you know, when people get old and it's their time, I suppose that's supposed to be some consolation. But, you know, with a child, it's quite different. So I just tried to put everything I knew about grief and everything I knew about adolescence together and see what happened.
Well, thank you. And I'm really looking forward to reading it.
Thank you.
I'm wondering what led you back to the Anne Frank story and what particular aspect of her life or how people viewed her or you focused on, and whether it led you to some new discoveries about her.
I reread it partly because I was working on the novel, as I said. I mean, I wanted, you know, what's been written about 13-year-old girls. Not so much new discoveries, but I noticed things that have been out there in plain view for years that people, for some reason, haven't paid much attention to. I mean, for example, the fact that she did rewrite the entire diary in the last 4 months of her life. You know, in the 80s, I guess the late 80s, the Netherlands Institute for War Documentation published this huge, massive version of the diary, and it's her original draft, version A, and it's printed in sort of bands. Her revisions, version B, and then version C, which is her father went and combined the first draft and the second draft to make. And actually, I have to say, you know, poor Otto Frank was so maligned for this or that, the other thing. He was a terrific editor. I mean, he did a really kind of terrific job. But nonetheless, what she wrote was quite different, or what she wanted in the book was quite different. I mean, for example, by the time she was arrested, she'd kind of gotten over Peter upstairs, so she'd written him out of the diary, basically. And the father wisely thought, a little teenage romance was not a bad idea for the diary. So he put all those sections back in the diary. Fine. You know, it was there. And interestingly, her revisions, I mean, just purely her version, has never been published as a standalone volume. You know, and then, you know, and then I was looking at the film, the play, what happened, you know, all that history. And, there, you know, there's an incredibly convoluted and awful story around the production of the play. So so that went into it, too.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you deal with Philip Roth's Ghostwriter?
Oh, what a work of genius. What an incredible book. It's, yeah, absolutely. And he took her seriously. I mean, that's the thing. Writers... Oh, I'm sorry. The question, I'm so sorry. The question is, did I deal with Philip Roth's The Ghostwriter? You know, and the hero, well, Zuckerman really has this fantasy that he's met the grown-up Anne Frank who survived, but at some point there's about a 4 or 5 page section in which he just talks about the diary, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful. So, yeah, I quote from it extensively. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.